liberals say and say that this could not have been written before the fact. Well, that's not true, but that's what they say. But look at the occasion of the vision. Verses 10:1 through 11:1, the whole chapter 10, we won't spend too much time on. Well, we might, but it's the introduction to the vision. You got that? All chapter 10 is the introduction to it. Introduction to this, to what is being predicted. In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that's 536 B.C., a message was, now that, by say king of Persia, that means the third year since the fall of Babylon, the third year of his reign over people of God. Third year of Cyrus, king of, not the third year of his reign, you understand that? This is 539, 538, 537, 536. The third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a message was revealed to Daniel, who was named Belteshazzar. And the message was true and one of great conflict. And we're going to see that about wars and strife. But he understood the message and had understanding of the vision. In those days, I, Daniel, had been mourning for 3 entire weeks. What were the reasons for his mourning? He doesn't say. I listed 2 possibilities in the syllabus. The sin, mourning over the sins of his people in general. Mourning over the plight of his people back in Judah. It says this were not going well. Should be things were not going well. Am I correct your syllabus? I know my grammar better than that. Things were not going well. In response to the decree of Cyrus, few had returned. They were suffering opposition from the Samaritans, and the weather was against them. You can read Nehemiah and get the account. So it's possible, you know, things were going bad. And Daniel was an old man. And he had been promised that the people could go home. And maybe he's really down. It's very human, isn't it? He's down about, maybe because things are not, I'm going to die before I see the thing I want to see most of all, the restoration of my people to the city, to the temple, and of the city and of the temple. I did not eat any tasty food, nor did meat or wine enter my mouth, nor did I use any ointment at all until the entire 3 weeks were completed. Now note this, was this a fast? Not exactly. It was a period of mourning. There's a difference between not eating because of a positive fast and something else to feel so rotten. You just don't feel like getting yourself, you know, he's saying, I didn't eat any tasty food. What do you eat? Whatever's at hand, bread and water, didn't shave, oatmeal. Well, no, that's tasty food. Oatmeal is one of God's great gifts.
I said that for Renee.
Tasty food is what I had last night at the Chinese restaurant that kept me awake all night. That's what's tasty food. I tasted it all night. It was talking about tasty. I took my folks out for Christmas last night. I'll take him out of Christmas for Christmas. They weren't here. What he's saying is he just felt so bad, so down, didn't shave, didn't clean himself up, didn't shower or shave, didn't eat anything, just what was at hand, water and bread.
Stayed alone.
Whether he wanted to or not. Now the 24th day of the first month, while I was by the bank of the great river, that is the Tigris, apparently he'd gone out, he was out in the wilderness or out in the open country. I lifted my eyes and looked, and behold, there was a certain man dressed in linen, whose waist was girded with a belt of pure gold of Uphaz. His body was like beryl. His face had the appearance of lightning. His eyes were like flaming torches. His arms and feet like the gleam of polished bronze. The sound of his words like the sound of a tumult. That would certainly get your attention. Now look at this. Who was this person? His identity. Well, I think it's clear that what we're looking at is a pre-incarnate manifestation of Christ. On what basis do I see that? Do I say this? Well, look at Revelation 1, 13 through 15. We find exactly the same appearance, the same figure, named. Turn to Revelation chapter 1, verses 13 through 15. And we see, the language is not exactly the same, but you'll see that the figure is the same. John is in the opening of his visions there on the Isle of Patmos, he says, verse 12, and having turned, I saw seven golden lampstands, and in the middle of the lampstands, one like a son of man, clothed in a robe reaching to his feet and girded across his belt with a golden girdle. What did this figure have back here? A linen, and he's dressed in linen, white. His waist was girded with a belt of pure gold. And his head and his hair were white like white wool, like snow, and his eyes were a flame of fire. What does it say in Daniel? His eyes were like flaming. His body also was like beryl. His face had the appearance of lightning. His eyes were like flaming torches. It's the same thing. And his feet were like burnished bronze, which has been caused to glow in a furnace, John says. His arms and feet, back in Daniel, like the gleam of polished bronze. And then look at verse 15 in Revelation 1. And his voice was like the sound of many waters. The sound of his words like the sound of a tumult, a storm, crashing waves, loud. Well, who is this in Revelation? He identifies himself. Verse 17 in Revelation. Do not be afraid. I am the first and the last, the living one. I was dead, and behold, I am alive forevermore, and I have the keys of death and Hades. I think it's very clear that John saw what Daniel saw. Who was this figure? It was a pre-incarnate manifestation of Christ. Now, the other possibility is Michael or another angel. But if this is another appearance of an angel, why are the details of his appearance given? Then I'll give another appearances of Gabriel and Michael. Okay. What was the symbolism of his appearance? White linen symbolizes purity, gold, high rank, or authority. And likely that's involved here. This is Oriental imagery. What are the effects on Daniel? Now I, Daniel, alone saw the vision, while the men who were with me did not see the vision. Nevertheless, a great dread fell on them, and they ran away to hide themselves. Who were with him? Well, don't know. But note this, they felt a great dread, but they did not see it. Well, a parallel situation to this, occasion to this in the New Testament. Somebody tell me what it is.
Saul on the road to Damascus,
where they heard the sound but did not hear the words. So because it was just as that manifestation of Christ on the road to Damascus was for Saul alone, this was for Daniel alone. So they ran away. They headed for high country. So I was left alone and saw this great vision. Yet no strength was left in me, for my natural color turned to a deathly pallor, and I retained no strength. Well, he, poor guy, had been mourning for 3 weeks, eating little of anything. And I'd have been flat on my back if I'd been eating three meals a day if I saw something like this. To do what now?
Well, he wasn't eating and he didn't take care of himself.
Yes. That's the universal custom. It's not custom, it's universal. The way people do. For instance, times of death, people don't feel like eating. And they have to make themselves, get up and take care of themselves. If you've ever been through a death, the real grief, you have to make yourself do the normal little everyday things that you would do without thinking about them. You don't want to see anybody, it's real mourning. And keep in mind, why did he? Well, there are three things that contributed to his retaining no strength. Number one, we've already mentioned the very fact, the fearsome character of the appearance. Second, his fact that he'd been mourning. And third, he was a very old man. Very old man. When I heard the sound of his words, and as soon as I heard the sound of his words, but I heard the sound of his words, and as soon as I heard the sound of his words, I fell into a deep sleep on my face, with my face to the ground. Then behold, a hand touched me. Set me trembling on my hands and knees. He's revived. And he said to me, O Daniel, man of high esteem. That's a good thing. That's interesting. Would you like to have God say it about us? Yeah. Man of high esteem, understand the words that I'm about to tell you and stand upright, for I have been now sent to you. And when he spoke this word to me, I stood up trembling. Said, Daniel, get up. Daniel, get up. I came here to talk to you. I've got a busy day. I came to talk to you, and I can't talk to a man who's passed out laying on his face. Stand up. I got something to tell you. So Daniel said, I got up, but I didn't stand there very well. I stood there trembling. Now, then he said to me, do not be afraid, Daniel. Now comes one of these enigmatic verses. For from the first day, I'm going to close this door, let the sound box distract me a little bit. I'm sure it's distracting me.
We're going to do it.
Thank you, Andrew. Then he said to me, do not be afraid, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart on understanding this and humbling yourself before God, that is, how long? 3 weeks? 3 weeks ago. Your words were heard, and I have come in response to your words. Had Daniel been praying, worrying about his people, the sins of his people? He said, now look, from the time you first started, I heard your words, and I've come. He said, but nothing. He said, but the prince of the kingdom of Persia was withstanding me for 21 days. Then behold, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, for I had been left there with the kings of Persia. Now I have come to give you an understanding of what will happen to your people. That's what Daniel was worried about. In the latter days, for the vision pertains to the days yet future. The hindering conflict with the prince of the kingdom of Persia raises some real questions, does it not? Now, Ephesians 6:12 says what? Right, we struggle not against flesh and blood, but against what? Principalities, powers, rulers of the darkness in high places, something like that, dark rulers of heavenly places, spiritual rulers. The suggestion, I'm reading the syllabus now, that Satan or a demon spirit of high rank was waging war against God with the mind of Cyrus as the primary battlefield. The suggestion of a worldwide hierarchy of demon spirits, a satanic kingdom in opposition to the kingdom of God, which is exactly what I believe. I think the scriptures teach this. I infer it from what the scriptures teach. That is, that Satan, as you know, there are, that we must not think of the angelic order of creation, which include what we call angels, also includes the demons, Satan and the demons. Satan and the demons are of the angelic order. Note that the word prince, he says, that I was in conflict, hindering conflict with the prince. Look what it says. With the prince of the kingdom of Persia. But it says Michael, one of the chief princes. Sar is the Hebrew word. Sar, chief princes. Now note this. Michael is called a prince in this text. One of the chief princes. Then we have the same word, prince of the king of Persia. Now we must, so first of all, I've called to your minds the angelic order of creation, which includes Satan, the demons, and the angels, so not quite. We must not think of them as in a cookie cutter kind of way, as if they were all the same. They are like men. That is, they are different. They have different names. They all have names. We know the names of two of the angels. All the angels have names, and all the demons have names. Those who work with demon possession, in some cases, demons, those who deal with demons and demon in casting out demons or dealing with demons in any way, one of the first things you must do is find out their names. Deal with them individually. They have names. Secondly, they have different abilities and powers. It's like people do. Different personalities. Remember the disciples who were having no trouble casting out demons until they came with the demons who were dealing with the little boy who was casting them, throwing himself in the fire. They brought him to Jesus and said, "We could not cast him out." What did Jesus say to them? This kind only comes out with fasting and prayer. This demon is different than what you've been dealing with. This kind comes not out except by fasting and prayer, or much fasting and prayer.
This is the pre-incarnate Christ, you know, who was having a battle with him. Why do you think it took him so long for, you know, why he couldn't just overcome
it? I'll come to that in a minute. Okay, hold on. That's an excellent question. It's right at the heart of our issue, but let me approach it on padded feet. Okay. Okay, you got that straight? That's true of angels and of demons. They are different. They have names. They have different personalities. They do different things. They have different roles, different ministries, and they are of different rank. And Satan has a dark kingdom with a hierarchy, just as God does. And I'm convinced, I infer from what the scriptures teach, both here and in statements like in Ephesians, and from common sense, that in Satan, in the satanic hierarchy, I think every person is on some demon's list. Now, you know, the Bible teaches we have, there are angels, that the children have angels. Jesus said, "Be careful how you treat the children." Their angel always beholds the face of the Heavenly Father. I infer from that that I think every person, and especially every Christian, is the immediate personal responsibility of some angel. Understand? I don't know if I have a single guardian angel whose only responsibility is me. Hebrews 1 talks about the angels who are ministering spirits for the saints. I'm not just guessing on this. Now, I do not know whether I have a single ministering spirit angel, but I am convinced that I am the responsibility of some angel. And I think the ministry of angels is more often seen not in things that happen, but in things that don't happen. That's just an opinion. And, in the same way, that every person is the responsibility of some demon in the dark kingdom, the kingdom of Satan. But, as you would expect, men of higher rank, men of authority, like the Kremlin, or like the King of Persia, the pagan empire, that they would be the immediate responsibility of ranking angels. That is, ranking demons, ranking demonic angels. That is, ranking demons would be put, they would be given ranking earthly rulers. And I think ranking angels are also sent out to struggle with them, to wrestle with them. Nobody said, I would, and Jesus himself, the incarnate Christ, was involved in some spiritual struggle involving Cyrus in some way, and we're not told what it is. And Michael came to help me. That's why I was late. Now, what does this mean? Now you understand what I've said so far? Which I think really casts, I don't think, if you don't understand that, if you don't believe that, I don't think you really understand what's going on. And I would point to a lot of circumstantial evidence. I would point out that human evil, it goes way beyond anything that the human environment could produce. And that there seems to be, whether a person believes in the devil or not, or the demons, A person has to be a real numbskull today to deny that there is an operative in our world, an active, progressive, intensive force of evil. Something rotten is going on. Men are not good. Men are not neutral. Men are evil. Not necessarily. Not necessarily. Now, the question, now we come to Mark's question. If this is Christ, why should he have a struggle? But you see, Mark, you might also ask the question, well, if I have a guardian angel, why am I not guaranteed against all calamity or misfortune? Whether it's a single angel or I'm just one of many which has the same angel. There are a finite number of angels and a finite number of demons. Large numbers, but finite. And the answer is, what is the limitation? How, Mark is asking, can either Christ, the pre-incarnate Christ, or Michael, a ranking angel who did not fall, of course Satan was an archangel who did fall, how could they be hindered? And the answer, again, this is an inference from the general teaching of Scripture, because he doesn't spell it out. The answer is that for the sake of free will, God has limited himself he's limited himself. That is, to preserve at least free will to some degree, some measure, he has imposed a temporary, underline the word temporary, self-limitation so that God himself has limited himself and therefore limited the angelic order as into what they can do to fight spiritual battles. Now this is the old, you see, what we're really raising, Mark, is the age-old question of the problem of evil. Why does God allow it? Can he not just step in, and why is it taking 3 weeks?
Is the spirit world outside of the time-space continuum?
No.
So when we say here that the angels fought a battle for 3 weeks, they fought a battle for 3 weeks. I thought maybe if they were outside, then it wasn't really 3 weeks. It could have been.
No. No, they're finite beings. They're in the time-space continuum. Now, they're not limited the way we are, but they are limited.
Wonder, is these 3 weeks...
But they're
the same as 3 weeks here. You know what I'm saying?
Yes. See, they are not omnipotent, nor are they omnipresent. Christ is. This particular manifestation raises some questions we don't know anything about. But the point is, it's really the question of why does God permit evil? Why could not God go in and just instantly remove all pagan evil forces? The answer is he could, but he would have to do that which he is not willing to do, and that is destroy human free will. Same way with Jesus. Why? See, it's the same issue. Why did Jesus struggle with evil men, talk with them and debate with them, and why didn't he just wave his hand and get rid of them? He would have to destroy man. Man would have to stop being man. So it's a part of this total, which we've had this question, which gets discussed in many classes for many reasons. I had a fellow time at the university one time. He said, I believe in people during the Vietnam War. He said, I believe in God, and God would just step in to stop the Vietnam War. I said, you would? I said, how would you like for God to do that? Well, he had a problem about that. I said, would you agree that the war is evil? Yes. And I said, would you agree that killing and slaughter, regardless of how you feel about the sides, would you agree that it's taking place because men choose to do what they're doing? He said, well, yes, I agree with that. And I said, therefore, would you be willing for God to destroy their free will so they wouldn't do it anymore? Well, yes, he said. You know, if that's what it takes to stop it, then God should do it. I said, would you be willing for God to destroy your free will to get rid of the evil in your life? No, it went bad. It went too far. You see what I'm saying? Yeah, that is, we say, well, I wish God would just stop all the evil men in the world. And if he has to destroy their free will, let him stop them. What's the kicker in that? You see, we are the evil men in the world. Aren't any? There are any other kinds of small children. See what I'm saying? So that it would be a universal. See, it's all or nothing is what I'm saying. So I don't, this doesn't, while Mark, to answer your question, to put a finishing touch on Manchin, while it does leave in my mind many unanswered questions, because we don't have the information, yet it does not, this does not seem strange to me, because I understand the overall principle that God, that is self-limitation, if God is going to have people in the world. Therefore, you understand it. So he's limited in what he, it's a self-imposed limitation of what he can do. Therefore, he can be hindered. Now, that's the general principle. What the particulars are, we're not told. But the principle is consistent with the overall picture you get in the scriptures of God and of man and of what's going on.
He says that Michael came to help him because he was detained there. Mm-hmm.
Well, detained in the sense he would be limited. I don't know. Why would he not be omnipresent? Well, I don't know. Now, why he would be detained is a part of the, it's part of the answer which I've given to Mark's question, that he is limited. Now, why, but your question is well taken, why would Michael need to help him? My only answer is, apparently, this is a part of the limitation. Why does God need the angels to help him with the little children? See, maybe the question is framed wrong. Maybe he doesn't need the help. Maybe that's just simply the way he chooses to operate. I might also ask the question, Angie, why did Jesus leave the job of preaching the gospel to men to help him save men? Why didn't he do that? Could Jesus have not sent out the word supernaturally? Why depend on people like Peter and Paul? You know, Peter couldn't keep his mouth shut, and Paul kept getting depressed, and me, one of the worst servants he ever had. Why does he use us? Does he have to? Well, maybe that's the wrong question. See what I'm saying? Maybe it's because he chooses to, for reasons of his own. But overall, that fact, if there's anything to that, it is under this embracing principle. It's included, it's embraced in this principle of self-imposed limitation. Why does he need ministering saints, ministering spirits for the saints? That's it, maybe he doesn't need that. Probably he doesn't. Let me say, well, do y'all understand her question? Good question. You understand my answer to it, whether there's a lot of speculation going on here. Let me say about this what I say about many questions of this sort. The answer is very, very simple. We just don't know what it is. Yeah, we get to heaven, we'll say, oh yeah. How could I have been so stupid?
I think it's just they were tied to. Yeah. What, Joe?
Did you know what he said? Yeah. Give a devotional note to this discussion. Does this not sober us and tell us that it is really true, remind us that it's really true that we wrestle not against spiritual, against flesh and blood, that the ultimate conflict is spiritual? What I'm saying to you is this, that this is one of the reasons why I'm in the ministry. See, the ministry, one of the things the minister is often looked upon by our modern materialistic world, not just the modern, the materialistic has always been looked this way. You see, many people, many fellows leave the ministry. I had a fellow, a friend of mine left the ministry, and he said he got tired of being irrelevant. And many ministers feel and are made to feel, many Christian workers feel and are made to feel irrelevant. The real world is going, by the way, this comes through on, on MASH, Father Mulcahy, he's always regretting the fact that he's not really doing anything significant because he's not a doctor. And we're made to feel this way, but you see, quite the opposite is true. You see, if what the Bible says is true, and it certainly appears to be true, then the preacher is on the first team. Everybody else on the second, okay, what else you're doing? You're on the second team or the third team. Those of us who are in the active work of the kingdom, the Christian worker, those who are actively involved with us in the pulpit or in the classroom or in the mission field, wherever it is, that's there at the point. If this is the kind of battle that's going on. It's sort of the debate between the sons of Martha and the sons of Mary, as Kipling words it. Maybe what Martha said, Mary's out there talking to Jesus about spiritual things. What's Martha doing? She's in the kitchen. And Martha takes the common worldview that the real practical people, those are the primary people. Mary's a dreamer, she's the spiritual person. And Martha said to Jesus, send her in here and help me. And what did Jesus say to Martha? Leave her alone. She has chosen what? The better part. Now Kipling wrote a poem called The Sons of Martha and the Sons of Mary, in which he took the position the sons of Martha were more important. Well, it takes both in the church, and we can't draw this distinction too clearly because often we play both roles. In some sense, we are the sons of Martha. In another sense, we're the sons of Mary. For instance, I make my living teaching the sons of Mary, but every payday, I'm sure glad for the sons of Martha. Understand? I'm glad for the guys who are in the factories and in the offices and who send money before the Christian college. And it's true. I mean, it's nice to be a son of Mary. It's nice to be Mary, but when it comes time to eat, you're sure glad that Martha was in the kitchen. But what I'm saying to you is this, that Mary had chosen the better part. That is, you see, here's what I'm teaching you, that the basic issues in the world today are not material, they are spiritual. It is the world of the spirit which is the primary world. That is, ideas undergird things. Let me give you an example. America is the greatest nation that has ever lived, has ever existed, ever been. Right? Certainly is. No question about that. Now, is it because she has greater material things, greater natural resources? Oh, no. Many countries have greater natural resources. And America is the greatest country in the world because it's built on the best ideas. It is the ideas that make her great, not her things. She has many things because she has great ideas, great principles. As soon as she loses her principles, notice we're losing our things because we're losing our principles. Let me word it this way. If the sons of Mary don't do their work, the sons of Martha will not have any food to fix. And that's the way it is. Therefore, if this is true, then it's an encouragement to us to know that we are not far from being irrelevant. We are the most relevant. It is those who are fighting the battle of the Spirit who are fighting the real battle. I maintain that the man in the pulpit, he's the supreme realist. He is fighting the real battle which is really going on. To the degree that you move away from the pulpit, to that degree, or do you just play games? I think on Sunday morning, when the Bible school teachers meet their classes, and the man mounts the pulpit, and the nursery class is taught, that's where the battle is being fought. What takes place on Monday morning through Friday in Washington, D.C., is secondary and relatively unimportant. Relatively unimportant. Understand? What Congress votes is not as important as what the preacher preaches. If we are struggling, if this is the nature of the struggle. The man who prays is the man and the woman who prays, they are the ones who are on the point. There was a hand, but I didn't go past the question.
This is something about what you talked about, that the preacher putting that he was not relevant. I can empathize with this to a certain extent, working with preachers over the years, I've noticed that several of them I've worked with are really interested in what's going on in the secular world. They're interested in the other guy's jobs. One preacher I know rides with the deputy sheriff every once in a while. And I think that that's pointing in that direction.
That's exactly what it is.
The rest of the world is, which is a good thing, but I think it ties into that.
To wanting to feel relevant. That's one of the reasons so many ministers have quit preaching and gone into counseling. They feel like that. They feel, now there's nothing wrong with that, but that's been the motive of many of them. They want to become more relevant. And that's very unfortunate. If you want, the most relevant thing we can do is preach the gospel of the kingdom. And however we do it. not to restore our confidence. I make no apologies for being a preacher. See, only we who look at things from a biblical viewpoint understand what's going on in the world. Why is it that governments generally fail to meet to address problems, at least on a long-term basis? The answer is they don't understand the problem. For you try to apply a political solution to a spiritual problem, it isn't going to work. We could give 1,000 examples. Look at the welfare system. Why is the welfare system creating poverty and degradation and destroying families? Because it's a materialistic political solution to what is basically a spiritual problem. Basically. Not in every case, not completely, but basically a spiritual problem. See what I'm saying? What most men need who are on welfare, most people, is not simply a check. They need a new heart. They need to repent. Now there are unfortunate cases. You understand, I'm not sweeping everybody with the same broom. But it's a spiritual problem. I always laugh at why has the government's program of criminal rehabilitation, why is it a 98% failure? The answer is, they don't have the foggiest notion what they're dealing with. Christian groups who deal with criminals have about 5 times the success rate as the secular psychological approach. Why? Well, at least they got some idea what they're dealing with. It's interesting. In the secular, I always laugh, the secular is going to close down the Christian. Why is the Christian school system teaching kids better than the secular system? Because they're more on target. They know what they're dealing with reality. And what the secular education is going to do is, their system doesn't work very well, but they want to close down the one that does work. Why? Well, it's not enlightened, you know, it's not certified. Well, is it teaching the kids? Well, yeah, but that's not the point. It's not certified. You know, it's not. Doesn't go by the book, our book. You see what I'm saying? So there's this whole debate going on. Well, I say this to encourage you. If what we read here in these words, I'm spending too much time on this, but this is so important to me, that we must see that the price we're paying to prepare ourselves to serve the Lord is worth it. And we are not irrelevant. We are the most relevant people. If this worldview is correct. Now listen, if this worldview is not correct, then we are irrelevant, not by being Christian leaders, but by being Christians at all. If this is not the right view, the church is a ridiculous joke. The Christian system is a fraud. It's a mistake. It can have both ways. Well, who was saying? Somebody was preaching. I heard. In Moby Dick. In Moby Dick. The whaling vessel out on the prow, the boat where the harpoon stands, the boat is extended out, a little ramp, a little deck extended out, and there's a little box up there, the cage where the harpoon stands. He's got a little rail around him. It's way out the rest of the ship. He's out there so he can harpoon the whale. And this little box, it's always out there first. It's where the ship is going. It's out in the wind, out in front of everybody else. And you know what they call that little box? The whaling ship? Call it the pulpit. You know, that's the most important part of the ship. It's out in front of everybody else. The ship is a whaling vessel. Without the pulpit and the harpoonist out there, it's just a statistical sight. It cannot function. Melville was making a point. There's a symbolism of that. That the world is like a ship. But what's out front? Leading the way, the most important part of it. What's out there where the wind is and the waves and the danger? It's the pulpit. Well. Now, any other questions on verses 12 and 13? That's really all I have to say about it. It's very enigmatic and interesting and exciting and scary. Now I have come to give you an understanding of what will happen to your people in the latter days, for the vision pertains to the days yet future, that is, after Daniel is going to be dead. I didn't say how far in the future yet. Yeah. And when he had spoken to me, according to these words, I turned my face toward the ground and became speechless. He bowed his head, dropped his head, because he was really about to fall down. He's in bad shape. And behold, one who resembles a human being was touching my lips. Who was this, one resembling a human being? Probably an angel. Then I opened my mouth and spoke, and said to him who was standing before me, O my Lord, as a result of the vision, anguish has come upon me, and I have retained no strength. It's a fancy way to say, here he's about to go, this is very human, he's about to pass out again. An angel, probably, comes and strengthens him, tilts it, helps him, encourages him. So he says to this pre-incarnate Christ, I'm having a tough time of it. You don't know how hard this is. I'm about to pass out. You're going to tell me all this important stuff, and I can't hardly even stand up. I love that. This is the kind of thing you'd never make up. It had to happen this way. You know, any kind of apocryphal story would never have included this. Here, you know, what is it because, you know, Daniel wrote it. He said, man, I had a tough time even keeping my feet. It reminds me of, and how can such a servant of my Lord talk with such as my Lord? How can one like me talk with one like you? One such as I talk to one such as you. As for me, there remains now, just now, no strength in me, nor has any breath been left in me. Here's Daniel trying to get this vision. What a great moment in his life, and he keeps passing out. Falls down, you know, and passes out, and they get him up, and he starts to pass out again, they get him up. I had a friend who now teaches in Cincinnati, Ken Goble. Ken Goble was a played basketball at the University of Virginia, I think, big, good athlete, Dr. Goble. And he married Max Randall's daughter. He would not be telling us about it. He's a great fellow. And they got married in Grassy Creek, Kentucky. He was preaching at the time. And in the dead, in the little Kentucky church down the creek bottom, and it was the dead of August or July, the dead heat of summer, no air conditioning, and two or three fans going, and everybody just sweating this wedding. And Ken, this big athlete, passed out right during the wedding. So they stopped the wedding, they get him up, and they give him smelling salts. They get him going again to get the wedding going, and he passed out again. Get him up. three or four times, like 100 times. It was a joke. We kidding him about it. He suffered after. We saw to it that he suffered for years under that. And they had to keep reviving him. And you know, and they go on for a long time. And so here's this bride standing there. She's sweating, you know, and she's fine, you know, but this athlete keeps passing out. And combination of the heat and being nervous and I don't know what all. And when I think of Daniel trying to get through this vision, I think of Ken trying to get through his own wedding. Now stand up, let's try it again.